Hello, everybody from Washington, D.C. Welcome to an episode of the Polititeen Podcast. My name is Damian Galvin, and I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Zane Balian.
It's great to be here.
Yes, it is. And today we have a wonderful guest with us, Mike Griner, is a guest that we've had on the program before, and we're very lucky to have back. Dr. Mike Griner is a passionate professor and researcher. He combines creative scholarship into the areas of corporate political activity and agency and stewardship theories, having a background in business, government, and law. And to introduce himself now, Professor.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're set for a very, very interesting conversation today, one that we've been looking forward to having since we scheduled it a few weeks back. And I think that it's going to be important here with kind of defining some background terms. So would you be willing to define corporate political activity for us? It seems like something that, you know, if you're just hearing it for the first time, might seem a little scary.
Yeah, you know, and it a lot of people do feel scared about it, frankly. You know, when you ask both average people and corporate executives, for that matter, most of them actually find it something very intimidating. You know, government is something that operates in a different format than most business people are used to, so they're unfamiliar with its terrain. And of course, we in the rest of the world always hear about the lobbyists in Washington and how they're impacting legislation, and how sometimes it seems that there's undue influence being taken up by business and by the wealthy, and that kind of crowds out the voices of everybody else. And unfortunately, it's a legitimate concern. But fundamentally, what corporate political activity is, it's how businesses engage with government to try to forward their own political interests, their own interests with the government. And it can involve anything like trying to impact how regulations are crafted or are implemented. It can go to impacting legislation, both at the federal and at the state level, and even the local level. And it's really been kind of a passionate area of research for me. And it's a growing area of research throughout our field, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. And something that I've seen growing not only with the field, but just kind of with the literature in and of itself is this term narcissistic CEO. Would you be able to explain exactly what that means?
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up. I actually just had a research article published that talked about how narcissistic CEOs tend to engage in more corporate political activity than those who are not. And particularly, I looked at corporate political activity a little bit, and one of the things that I was able to do is kind of distinguish between corporate political activity that's aimed at trying to deliver certain benefits for the corporation versus corporate political activity that's aimed at trying to deliver some kind of personal consumption benefits to the CEO. And, you know, just bear with me here a sec while I kind of dig into this a little bit. You know,
absolutely.
When we engage in political activity, we do it because we get some type of personal satisfaction from it, you know, and we academics like to call that a consumption benefit, you know, that we feel like we're doing something positive, we're benefiting the ideology that we support. There's also a sense of community that we get from it. But most of the research has pointed to that really this idea that when you engage in politics, you're trying to get some type of sense that you're somehow pushing the ideology that you support. So it makes sense that if you're trying to pursue your own ideological goals, that you tend to maybe be a little bit more extreme in those views, you know, maybe pushing a more conservative or more liberal views, just depending upon how you personally feel about those issues. That doesn't work, though, when you're trying to build a coalition of, say, members of Congress or members of a regulatory agency, when you're trying to build a coalition of them large enough to actually pass legislation that you support. So what we found is that where companies are trying to engage in corporate political activity that benefits their bottom line and actually benefits their employees and everybody involved in it, that they tend to focus on more moderate political issues and more moderate political characters, you know, different members of Congress who might be more in the middle, more kind of the work horses, not the show horses type. Whereas those where they're trying to get some type of consumption benefit, you know, this sense of satisfaction that they're pursuing their ideological goals, they tend to pursue a more extreme agenda. And what we found is that where you have narcissistic CEOs, which again would be, you know, it's almost self-explanatory, you know, where they are the CEOs of the company, but they tend to be more narcissistic than other CEOs. Seems almost like a conflict of terms because you'd assume that all CEOs are narcissistic. And to an extent, they are, but there are some that are more narcissistic than others. And what we found is that the most narcissistic tend to engage in the most extreme political activity. So they're kind of taking advantage of the fact that they're the heads of these companies, that they're essentially trustees in charge of these funds that have been given to them by the investors in the company, and they're using it to satisfy their own personal agenda that they've got, to get their own personal satisfaction, the consumption benefit that we talked about.
Now, when we discuss narcissistic CEOs, are we, it by reaching the term CEO narcissism, does that only occur when, or does that occur whenever a CEO is acting in his or her self-interest over the corporate interest? Or does this refer to a certain extent of activity, like what you just mentioned with certain political activities? Is that the kind of the threshold of this term CEO narcissism, or is it just CEOs acting in their own self-interest generally?
Yeah, I think it's actually, it goes beyond CEOs just acting in their own self-interest. You know, when you have a narcissistic CEO, they tend to want to be the center of attention. You know, I'm sure we can all imagine certain characters who are well-known, who like love to be the center of attention and love to have the media paying attention to them. And that's really what defines a narcissistic CEO, or for that matter, a narcissistic in any circumstances, which is somebody who just likes to be the center of attention, and they love drama, and they love to be at the center of any kind of debate. And research actually has been done quite extensively about narcissistic CEOs, and they found some interesting results. Like, for example, research has found that companies that are led by CEOs who tend to be more narcissistic, they perform about the same as firms that tend to be led by CEOs that are not as narcissistic, but they tend to engage in these wild swings of performance. So, like, they take bigger risks and will have larger upsides and larger downsides than companies that are led by less narcissistic CEOs that tend to be more stable. There's also been a finding about corporate social responsibility, you know, where companies will try to invest in certain community activities. And interestingly enough, you know, this has kind of been one of the findings, that narcissistic CEOs tend to lead companies that engage in more corporate social responsibility activities. You can imagine it, you know, where the CEOs will love to be the people showing up at these events with the big scissors, you know, cutting the ribbon that is at the entrance to some new location that they're helping to pay for. And so you see this spreading throughout, where the personality trait of the CEO tends to then kind of wash over how the company engages in business in all kinds of different activities. And one of those is in corporate political activity. One of those is in kind of the strategies that the business adopts, and then also corporate social responsibility as well.
Yeah, and this seems like an interesting topic. And something that I'm getting curious about as we're delving into this conversation is, one, what are the immediate harms that come with having a narcissistic CEO? And second, are there any benefits? You know, is there any benefits beyond what was just mentioned with obviously some of these corporations performing better?
Yeah, you know, I think anybody who's worked with a narcissist, I have had the unfortunate pleasure of having worked with a narcissistic boss, knows that it is not a fun experience. You know, they certainly, the from a human resources perspective, they tend to want to have everybody pay attention to themselves rather than pay attention to the team. And what's interesting, you know, is some of the, you know, since we're delving into this a little bit, some of the ways that they've measured the level of narcissism of CEOs, for example, is that they've looked at the annual reports of companies. And what they found is that certain companies have an annual report with a huge picture of the CEO spread across the pages. And then they have other companies where the CEO has barely any picture at all. If anything, some tiny little picture of them in the corner of some page where they've got their the letter to the firm. There's also been some research that suggested that the use of I versus the use of we can tend to point to somebody being narcissistic rather than more, I guess, less narcissistic, more focused on the team aspects. And so you can see where that would be a real negative. But again, as you say, you know, the narcissistic CEOs do tend to take these extreme risks. And when they do, and they pay off big. You know, I mean, I don't want to speak out of turn here, but let's just use an example here of, say, Elon Musk, okay? Elon Musk, I think most people would agree, based upon what we've seen, might qualify as one of the worst bosses in America right now. You know, and some of his investments have not turned out very well. Yeah. But that being said, we probably owe Elon Musk, with his vision, for really getting us to the point where electric cars were a viable thing globally. Mm-hmm. That's really quite an achievement on his part. And were it not for his narcissism and belief in himself and this attitude that, hey, I can do anything and I want to be the person who everybody is kind of bowing down to and worshiping, we wouldn't have this thing that's a benefit that's going to be a positive for society as a whole.
I'm so glad you brought up the Elon Musk example. I think it's very fitting for this conversation. What I want to ask is, so in most companies, the CEO has an obligation to the shareholders or to the board of trustees. And we can take Elon Musk's case for an example, especially in the past couple of years with what he's tweeted, getting into hot water with the SEC. How come boards or trusts or shareholders, how come they tolerate these narcissistic CEOs? Is it the willingness to see these guys take the risk and hope they pay off?
Yeah, you know, that is a great question. You guys are really asking some great questions here. And that really kind of comes to the central question, actually, that I focus on in my research, which is how this happens. You know, we call it corporate governance in academia, where we talk about the fact that you've got these certain kinds of tools that are set up to try to manage CEOs and try to get them and the executive team as a whole to focus on delivering returns for the shareholders. Because you're right, that is actually, under American law, the primary requirement for CEOs and for their management teams. They are required to deliver returns for the shareholders. You know, we love to talk about the fact that CEOs, they're focused on, you know, making a good experience for employees or helping society or, you know, making some kind of positive change overall. And that's all well and good. But ultimately, in the United States, the law is that CEOs have to deliver return for the shareholders. Period. End of story. That's it. And whenever there's a conflict between the CEOs wanting to, say, do one of these other activities and this obligation of them to deliver return to the shareholders, they actually, under the law, are obligated to deliver return for the shareholders. So you can see where this could lead to certain abuses, for example, where companies might pollute more because as a result of that, they're able to deliver larger returns to the shareholders. Well, under the law, you know, unless there's some contrary law also saying that they cannot engage in pollution, you know, that hated word that we call regulation, then CEOs will do that because that's their job. That's what the law tells them to do. But by the same token, you know, CEOs are people. And what they have then is that they have this inherent desire to do things that are going to benefit themselves. And that's where we run into sometimes this challenge where, on the one hand, CEOs want to take care of themselves. They have one interest, but yet there might be a differing interest that the shareholders have. And let me give you a great example of this. This is, let's say that the CEO is leading a company. And that company is the subject of a takeover bid. And the company that's trying to take them over, the investors that are trying to take it over, offer a substantial premium over the current share price of the company. Well, then that's something that the shareholders would be very interested in, right? You know, they're saying, hey, we're going to get a great return on our investment here because this company that's trying to buy our shares are going to give us a lot more than the shares are currently worth on the market. However, to the CEO and his or her management team, they're saying, wait a minute, this isn't so great for us because guess what's going to happen when this new company takes over? We're probably going to lose our jobs. And that gets you into the kind of the basic conflicts that you see here. And you see this conflict then exhibiting itself throughout the company, you know, different activities that they engage in, like different choices the company makes. And for that matter, you know, just being socially responsible, you know, that in and of itself has been argued is an abuse of the power that the CEO has to manage the company. Because one of the most famous economists out there, actually, who the Nobel Prize winner, Milton Friedman, once said famously that the social responsibility of business is to make a profit, which I think encapsulates perfectly what the law is in the United States, which is that they're supposed to, that the CEOs are supposed to be focused on making a profit. But yet they do more than that. You know, they do other things. They do engage in this political activity. And to what extent are they engaging in political activity that benefits the company and ultimately benefits the shareholders? To what extent are they engaging in corporate social responsibility that benefits the company and ultimately benefits the shareholders? And to what extent are they engaging in strategies that ultimately benefit the company and benefit the shareholders versus benefiting themselves? You know, and there are lots of examples of this where we talk about CEOs, for example, getting themselves perquisites, you know, like cool corporate jets. You know, I was just reading yesterday, for example, that the CEO of, I believe it's Boeing, doesn't actually go into the office very often. And when he does go into the office, he's flown by a corporate jet. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm not flown into my work by a private corporate jet. And the fact that this is being paid for by the shareholders makes them wonder, is this really something that's a good use of our money? Let me give you another example here. And please tell me if I'm going a little overboard here.
No, not at all.
Whenever you ask a professor about their research, you know, you're getting yourself into trouble.
That's the goal here, right? That's the goal.
So here's another example. So a few years ago, and I'm sure many of you read about this, there was a case where I believe it was Wells Fargo Bank that they had engaged in the process of different employees were essentially signing up people for accounts that these people didn't sign up for. You know, so these people were getting obligated to make certain payments that they had never committed to. And this became a huge fraud that was a huge scandal for the company. And the Department of Justice got involved in it. And they ended up pursuing the company and the executives who were kind of leading this effort. Because, I mean, let's face it, the employees down at the ground level in the different branches who were signing up customers for these fake accounts, they weren't the ones who kind of made the policy that resulted in these fake accounts happening. You know, they were being pressured from above that, oh, you need to sign up certain number of accounts per week. And if they didn't, they'd lose their job. So what did the people do? They found themselves in a position where if they had a bad week, they'd have to kind of make up accounts to make up the difference. And you can bet that the executives at the top knew that, maybe something like this is happening, but, you know, we're going to kind of look the other way, okay? So who benefited from this arrangement? Well, it would have been the CEOs at the top who could then turn around and say, you know, hey, look, you know, we're delivering these great returns for our shareholders. And at the same time, the employees at the bottom, they're just kind of keeping their jobs, basically, all right? So then you have the Department of Justice comes in and says, you know, we're going to pursue this. This is a criminal activity that you're engaging in, and we're going to demand that you pay some kind of compensation. Now, the compensation that was paid by Wells Fargo. Okay, so whose money was being spent? It was being spent by the shareholders, you know, because if that money weren't being given to the government, ultimately it would be going down to the bottom line and be able to be distributed to the shareholders as dividends or investments in the company that would make their shares more valuable. But yet, who is it protecting? The people who were in danger of going to prison as a result of this were not the shareholders. They were the executives at the top of the company who started this problem in the first place. So you can see where the executives took advantage of their position and the fact that they have control of this money that belongs to the shareholders to use it in a way that it benefited themselves rather than benefiting the company. And that's a big problem right now. And you can see this reflected in the political activity that they engage in. You know, again, are these CEOs engaging in political activity that benefits the company? Are they engaging in political activity that gives them some kind of personal satisfaction at the expense of the shareholders? Right. And similarly with corporate social responsibility. Now, a lot of research has shown that corporate socially responsible activities actually helps the company bottom line, you know, but there are certain activities that are going to benefit the bottom line more than others. Is that activity, again, being driven by a desire by the CEO to do something that's going to benefit the company's bottom line? Or is it being driven by the CEO's desire to be standing in front of the cameras, cutting the ribbon to some new center that they've helped to finance at the expense of the shareholders? Again, so this is a big problem. And what American law does is we have something called the business judgment rule. And what that does is it gives a lot of flexibility to the executives, a lot of leeway to them, and really kind of ties the hands of the shareholders. The solution that we've provided to the shareholders is, hey, if you don't like it, sell the stock and buy another, right? But the problem that we run into is that we what we call an information problem, you know, where on the one hand, the CEOs know what's going on. They know what's going on inside the company. Do the shareholders really know what's going on in the company? And for that matter, do the board members even know what's going on in the company? Something that we've seen a lot of are where board members, for example, essentially get co-opted by the top management team because the board members, you know, they kind of get close with them. They kind of become buddies and they kind of look the other way, even knowing that things will happen. But then suddenly when things blow up in their face, you see the board members all of a sudden rushing to try to throw the top management team under the bus when they were involved in this crisis right from the beginning.
I'm glad you mentioned specifically the responsibility corporations have under U.S. law to make a profit for their shareholders. And what I want to ask is, especially considering what you just mentioned about how shareholders often don't even have that much flexibility to do anything in these situations. So if, for a CEO's perspective, if the company is profitable and the stock is going up, are they essentially in a position where they kind of just have the ability to do whatever else because the firm is profitable? There's nothing the shareholders really can gripe about.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And that's part of the problem here is that, you know, the question is, let's say you've got a successful company that's profitable. Could it be more profitable? Could that be delivering more return to the shareholders? And, you know, that seems like one of those questions of, is that really a question worth asking? But I mean, let's face it, that's the way our economy works. And if this money is not being returned to the shareholders, at least in theory, then that's money that is not going to be then invested in new activities, you know? So it ends up impacting our economy broadly. And so as a result of that, you get into this situation where there's no way to really know if the CEOs are delivering the ultimate return that they could be delivering. You know, we kind of have to take their word on it. And who's giving them the information? Well, it'd be the CEOs themselves. You know, they're the ones making the presentations to the boards and telling them, you know, how great everything's going. Do you really think that if things weren't going great, the CEOs would be telling the board members that? The only time it comes up suddenly is when the CEOs find themselves in such trouble that they have no choice but to tell the board. And then again, a lot of the time you'll see the board running around and going, kind of trying to hide its head, trying to throw the CEO under the bus. You know, a few years ago, we had this situation come up with Tyco. Some of you might have read about this. This was a New Hampshire manufacturing company, and they were led by a CEO called Dennis Kozlowski. And the company was actually quite successful, and they were growing very quickly. And the CEO had really made a name for himself by buying up a lot of smaller companies that were underperforming, and they were able very successfully to actually turn these companies into better performing divisions of this conglomerate. Well, this was all happening at about the same time that you had everything that went on with Enron and with WorldCom and those other scandals that were really just criminal activities on the part of these different businesses. Well, in the case of Tyco, it turned out that while the company was doing incredibly well, the CEO, you know, well, he had some perks, as we talked about, that were pretty questionable. For example, they bought a house in New York for the CEO to use when he was there on business, and in that house they decorated it. And one of the decorations that was pointed to was that there was a shower curtain that cost $6,000. You know, pretty shocking. There was also an example of a birthday party that was held by the CEO for his wife that cost $2 million. And it was in Tuscany, and they had people walking around in togas, you know, models walking around in togas, and they had Jimmy Buffett come and perform and everything. And this became quite the scandal. And the argument was that, oh, you know, this was paid for, at least in part, by Tyco because of the fact that it was also linked to a corporate retreat. Well, you know, all of a sudden, after this all got revealed, the board members went crazy and said, oh my God, the CEO, he ended up, essentially stealing money from the company, and the CEO ended up being convicted. Now, whether you like that or not, the thing that jumps out at me looking at this whole situation is, wait a minute, where was the board when this was all happening? Board members were probably at this event. They didn't say anything back then because, hey, everything's great. You know, the CEO tells us everything's great. And it's only when kind of the stuff hits the fan that all of a sudden the board is saying, oh my gosh, you know, we need to do something about this. And that's a big problem that we've got right now in America, which is this kind of lax corporate governance, where CEOs really are essentially allowed to do whatever they want. And there's very little that anybody can do about it. And if they want to choose to do something that's in their own self-interest rather than the interest of the shareholders, really, kind of tough luck to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, one of these hot topic conversations that we've had in these past couple years, and I'm not sure necessarily how much academic research there is into this matter, but it's been the issue of NFTs, of cryptocurrency, of these new forms of doing business, if you will. Would you be able to talk about what type of problems this brings that we didn't necessarily previously see before with, I guess, traditional ways of doing business, if you will?
Yeah, you know, this type of thing is really scary to me, I got to tell you. And I've actually got a long record of warning people against engaging in investments with cryptocurrency because, you know, the problem is there's no regulation for it. There's no commitment for it. And people love to say, you know, oh, you know, the US dollar, it's not really based on anything. But the US dollar is based upon the full faith and credit of the United States. That's a pretty good backing for the US dollar, you know? You don't see any of that with the cryptocurrencies. And unfortunately, what we've seen a lot of with these cryptocurrencies is kind of what they call pumping and dumping, which is where they'll set up a cryptocurrency, they'll promote it as, oh, this is going to be the next big thing, you should definitely get in on this. And we even saw ads. I remember going to the movie theater and seeing these ads that featured, I think, Matt Damon and other famous stars talking about how, you know, oh, you know, you got to invest in cryptocurrency because it's the future. And they end up kind of boosting the value of these cryptocurrencies based on nothing other than this kind of sense of expectation that, oh, something could come from it. But they're really not worth anything, ultimately. And as a result of that, once it reaches a certain level, you see the people who are the promoters of this being able to sell their interest in it, usually for a huge profit. And then it suddenly creates a situation where as they're selling, it kind of leaves the bag, I guess you could say, to the retail investors who've come in at the end, usually spending a lot of money and who end up typically losing a lot of money as a result of these investments. You know, I got to tell you, the research is not kind to this cryptocurrency in terms of the impact that it has on retail investors. And if you are not, frankly, the founder and the promoter of a cryptocurrency and you're investing in it, I got news for you. You're the mark.
Yeah, and it's definitely something that everyone needs to be on the lookout for. Obviously, we've seen the collapse of several cryptocurrency, chains, if you will. And it was extremely interesting seeing all of these figures that were getting into the cryptocurrency scene. You had Matt Damon. I mean, you would watch the late night show with Jimmy Fallon, and you'd watch them pull out, these cartoon monkeys and talk about how they bought them for X amount of money and whatnot. But with that being said, Professor, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program today. This was an amazing conversation. It went 100 times better than I could have imagined. It was genuinely interesting and intriguing. And I'm sure that our audience loved it. And if you want to take a second to, you know, shout out anything that that you're doing, or you know, your social media platforms, anything, feel free.
Yeah, it's just great to be here. I love your guys' show, and I'm just so happy that you guys ended up inviting me back.
Yeah, absolutely, and we're very happy that you decided to join us again, and I can guarantee you will be on the show very, very soon once more. But with that being said, I want to thank Zane for joining me, as always, and to our listeners for tuning in to yet another episode of the Politatine Podcast. If you guys want to stay in tune with anything that we're doing, be sure to head over to oxinstitute.org, and with that being said, thank you so much for tuning in to yet another episode. Goodbye.